program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today we will begin with Disneyland with No People, My Encounter with a Giant of American Photography. This is written by Steve Martin. When I was 17, I worked at Fantasyland's magic shop as a magician demonstrating Svengali decks, cups and balls, and the incredible, their word, shrinking die. I loved working to exhaustion, and I was proud to become the shop's youngest night manager. When Disneyland's summer hours were extended to 9 p.m. on weekdays and midnight on weekends, I was in heaven. I could watch date night unfold, allowing me to observe and absorb teen romantic norms. One night, however, a chance encounter with a renowned artist was to grip me more than 60 years later, setting my nostalgia for Disneyland in dramatic black and white. A summer evening in 1962. The fireworks were over, the crowds dwindled, and the store emptied. I counted out the register, turned out the lights, and locked the hand-carved sorcerer's doors behind me. My usual route was through Sleeping Beauty's castle, over the moat via a working drawbridge. But tonight a security guard stopped me. "Can't go that way. Gotta go out the side exit." "Why?" I asked. He said, "There's a photographer taking a picture." I obediently took the adjacent side route. In those days, film was expensive, so no one stepped in front of even the most casual snapshot. I passed the photographer, a woman. I wanted to say I remember the camera, whether it was on a tripod or whether she held it, and what she was wearing, but I can't. I want to say I was there when the camera clicked as I strolled by, but I can't. I want to say I stopped and chatted. I didn't, but I wish I had. Because the photographer was Diane Arbus. Arbus, among the most renowned photographers of the 20th century, is known for her photographs of the outliers next door. Carnies, identical twins, exotic dancers, and weightlifters, among others. It's sloppy to call her subjects freaks, as some observers did, a term that slanders the subjects as well as the photographer. She found people to photograph who were visually captivating and dignified, and who pulled us into fringe worlds that most of us knew nothing about. Her photos without people as subjects are rare, and more rarely shown. There exist only a dozen or so depopulated images, including a puddle on a sidewalk, a wax museum axe murderer — I'm calling a waxen axe murderer a non-person — a facade of a Hollywood movie set with scaffolding propping up a skeletal shell, and the creepy interior of a dark ride at Coney Island. After a bus trip from Manhattan to Southern California, she decided to photograph what she called, quote, pseudo-places, end quote, an apt description of Disneyland's high, rampant whimsy. Her notebook from the period: "I have found the most wonderful pseudo-places at dawn in Disneyland, ruins of Cambodian temples which never existed, false deserts littered with bones of animals who never died, mountain like a shrine for unbelievers, and black swans swim in the moat of a castle which looks like the advertisement for a dream." The presence of Disneyland's guests in the photos, I suppose, would have given the photos a souvenir context that would have rendered them flat. So Arbus arranged access in the off hours, when the park would be empty. The park's rules were more easygoing then. Remember, I started when I was 10 years old and was paid my day's earnings, about $1.50, in cash. She turned her camera on Skull Rock, a self-explanatory name describing an outcropping of plaster, where a yo-ho-ho dead man's skull emerges out of the volcanic upheaval around the corner from Mr. Toad and just behind the Chicken of the Sea pirate ship. Arbus's photos transform a fake scary place into an actual scary place. The photograph is a nightmare material for both children and adults. She also shot a sunset scene of Ersatz boulders looking like a carapace army resting on transports, waiting to be moved into place. The image is officially titled Rocks on Wheels, Disneyland, California, 1962. But it is undoubtedly misnamed. The setting is a mountainous terrain, probably the Anaheim Hills, whereas Disneyland's domain is as flat as Kansas. The rocks were traveling to and had not yet arrived at Disneyland. The photo delivers a Dali-esque strain of surrealism, as well as a dash of humor, but only if you want it. In Arbus's Disneyland series, humor was the last thing on her mind. The inevitable irony inherent in pointing out phony places, motels that look like teepees and giant roadside dinosaurs, is absent from these honestly delivered photos. Her final Disneyland image is of Sleeping Beauty's castle, the perfect pseudo-place, and my home away from home, where I heard Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty waltz on a loop. The castle's authority makes you believe it's real, despite being smaller than it should be, prettier than it should be. If you turned your head to the right, you could see a TWA rocket ship ready for launch to the moon. Arbus photographed the castle as though it were a delectable suite, more akin to what it was to us Disneyland romantics than to a Manhattan ironist. There is perhaps no mockery in the photo. If there is, certainly the glowing white swan gliding on the moat's black water doesn't show it. As the decades passed, I became more conversant with Arbus's work, but I remained unaware of the castle image until much, much later. When I finally saw the castle photo, it was like being surprised by a snapshot of your toy box from when you were five. A sudden yank back in time, pulled not by just by familiarity, but by a tangible recall of time and place, with the mood exactly right. For the first time in years, I remembered the incident with the mysterious photographer. Research showed that the dates lined up, the hours lined up, and the location lined up. The after-hours lone photographer I passed was undoubtedly Diane Arbus. My nostalgia, more like melancholy, for Disneyland has waned, but is not absent. It has been replaced by a bundle of more recent memories of family and parenthood. But seeing the image now, nearly 65 years later, I am taken back to the castle undimmed, starlit, swan-lit. In Arbus's mind, I'm sure the photo was slightly bent, but to me it is accurate, straightforward, and ever so real, even if it is pseudo. Our second story. Why calls to, quote, save democracy, end quote, don't work. Written by Katie Osborne and Scott Warren. Given President Trump's disregard for longstanding political norms and his efforts to overturn the 2020 election, many Americans fear that he is hostile to democracy. According to this view, the 49.8% of voters who supported him in 2024 must simply be unaware of the existential threat he poses to our republic. The logic, to Trump's critics, is therefore simple. Once voters fully grasp that democracy is under threat from creeping authoritarianism, then surely they will turn against Trump. Yet this strategy has largely fallen flat. Why? The consulting and pro-democracy organizations where we work have spent the past few months with conservative Trump voters across three counties in Wyoming, Michigan, and South Carolina. We learned that many do indeed revere America's founding design, including the Constitution, free and fair elections, the Electoral College, and the rule of law. But these voters feel that government institutions have drifted from their founding values and priorities, which they classify as faith, or the belief that moral authority precedes political authority. Family, the primary unit of social life and obligation, freedom, mainly from government overreach, and place, or the importance of local community, over national abstraction. The people we spoke with explained that by forsaking these values, the country's political institutions have lost touch with the moral ethos that they believe should guide public life, and that these institutions were designed to protect. Our research involved conducting in-depth interviews with and observing the daily lives of dozens of people, along with their friends, families, and neighbors, to better understand how they think about American democracy right now. Our goal was not to persuade or judge, but to figure out why public trust in national institutions has plummeted to historic lows and what might be done to build it back up. We learned that the central question for the conservatives we met is not, should America be a democracy? Instead, it is, has American democracy remained faithful to what makes it legitimate? Democratic institutions are legitimate in the view of conservatives when they honor and protect the faith, freedom, families, and community of their constituents. When institutions and the politicians who inhabit them fail to appreciate the centrality of these core values, they become illegitimate. One participant, Sarah, a 30-something mother of three in rural Wyoming, grew up poor, the daughter of a single teen mom. From the time she was 10, her local church fed her family, cared for her when her mother couldn't be around, and surrounded her with people who treated her with dignity. In 2008, at age 18, she strongly considered voting for Barack Obama for president. She appreciated his care for struggling Americans and believed his promises of change. The parents of her boyfriend at the time didn't argue with her. Instead, her future in-laws listened and then asked, "Who brought you out of poverty?" The answer, Sarah realized, was not the federal government, but her church community, a view that she believed put her closer to the priorities and policies of conservatives rather than Democrats. Nearly 20 years later, Sarah told us that virtually every major institution she has encountered in her life, including public schools, hospitals, and various federal agencies, has squandered her trust and fallen short of what her church gave her. Having witnessed the shortcomings of the public school system firsthand as a teacher, Sarah now homeschools her children. When neurologists dismissed her young son's recurring seizures, she turned to a network of mothers online to crowdsource a diagnosis and treatment plan, which largely entailed avoiding certain government-sanctioned products and chemicals. When we met her, her son hadn't had a seizure for more than a year. During the coronavirus pandemic, Sarah watched policies that seemed designed for urbanites arrive in her rural town without the consent of residents or evidence of their local efficacy. She threw herself into local activism, showing up to county meetings, local boards, and precinct caucuses. She now aligns herself with a chapter of the right-wing Freedom Caucus. Across Wyoming, Michigan, and South Carolina, we heard stories like Sarah's. Conventional institutions had failed participants, and faith and values-aligned organizations filled the gap. This is why calls to restore power to government institutions ring hollow, and why the Democratic Party's faith in institutions can appear naive and godless. As Thomas, a rural South Carolinian who comes from a family with a long history of military service and civic engagement, told us, "Democrats see government as their God, while conservatives see their God as God, and government as sort of secondary." Disappointment and distrust in much of government, owing to the ways these institutions have seemingly abandoned the priorities that made them just and meaningful, have hardened into a worldview. one that dismisses democratic values and norms as expendable if they don't reinforce what is morally essential. As Sam, a small business owner in Michigan, put it, political norms are just like culture, right? Norms just mean how we have always done things. So I think that's fine to disrupt. Which brings us to Trump. How can people with such a strong attachment to faith and family vote for someone who criticizes religious leaders and defies so many ethical standards? We learned that these voters evaluate Trump not as a model of their values, but as a defender of them. I don't like him as a person, Cindy, a 50-something nurse in South Carolina, told us, but I like him as a president. A number of respondents expressed gratitude for the way Trump has worked to protect their communities and livelihoods, particularly in coal country. Sarah told us, for example, that when Trump returned to office, her husband, a land surveyor in Wyoming, was nearly unemployed, and the family was worried about making ends meet. But thanks to the president's reversal of Biden-era restrictions on coal mining, her husband is now overwhelmed with work. Such moves have made Trump a hero in parts of the country where Americans have been unwilling or unable to pivot away from coal. This view of Trump as a protector of the country's core values and interests also helps explain how participants reconcile the president's interventionist policies and growing executive power with their stated preferences for small, local governance. Many of the people with whom we spoke justified Trump's aggressive use of federal power as a necessary response to hostile institutions that have violated their constitutional mandate. When the FBI investigates Trump, when government agencies mandate vaccines, when the Department of Education influences local curricula, voters say these institutions have exceeded their legitimate authority. In cracking down on these institutional breaches, Trump is not breaking the rules, but defending the foundation the rules were meant to protect. Do I think Trump's all the time great? No, but I do think he's fighting for everyone right now. Kyle, a 20-something delivery driver in rural Wyoming, told us. Our research suggests that activists seeking to protect American democracy from authoritarian influences are pursuing a failing strategy. They are defending largely abstract democratic processes, such as norms and rules, on the assumption that everyone agrees that they are legitimate and worth saving. But such arguments are unlikely to resonate with voters who have come to believe that many of these norms and processes have abandoned the country's bedrock values. Calls to defend democracy promise to alienate anyone who feels that democratic institutions have somehow failed them. Few care to preserve a system they feel stopped serving its purpose long ago. Next, the millions of songs mashed into AI-generated music, written by Alex Reisner. Last November, a pair of Olympic-bound figure skaters performed in a competition to a song with lyrics that sounded oddly familiar. "Every night we smash a Mercedes-Benz," the singer began. It was one of several recognizable lines from the 1998 pop hit "You Get What You Give" by the New Radicals. But the Ice Dancers' song was otherwise different. The New Radicals' message to angsty teenagers had been converted to Bon Jovi-style arena rock. If you knew you get what you give, this was a pretty strange variation on it. The dancers had used music generated by AI. Whatever model was involved had likely been trained on "You Get What You Give" and had copied some of the song's content, as AI systems are prone to do. Such systems don't always reproduce elements of existing songs in this way, but you'll hear it now and then, and sometimes even more blatantly. Suno, one of the most popular AI music generators, for example, has pumped out tracks that strongly resemble Michael Jackson's Thriller, Ed Sheeran's Shape of You, Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good, Bill Haley and his Comets' Rock Around the Clock, B.B. King's The Thrill Is Gone, and others. Thriller is just one of dozens of examples provided by the major record labels in a lawsuit against Suno. Rachel Rakusin, a spokesperson for Suno, told me that the platform uses, quote, safeguards to protect against unauthorized distribution, impersonation, and manipulations. Cases like these indicate something about how AI-based music products work. AI music generators can simulate human performances with surprising fidelity, but first they have to be trained on enormous quantities of those human performances. The actual recordings that go into any model are a closely guarded secret. But the number of songs is almost certainly huge, spanning genres and time periods. As part of my series into the investigations into AI training data, I recently discovered four giant data sets of songs that are being shared within the AI development community. One has 12 million tracks. Another has 9 million. The two smaller data sets each have more than 100,000 songs. They include hits from major pop artists such as Bad Bunny, Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, Pearl Jam, Elvis Costello, Sheryl Crow, and The Beatles. Jazz artists such as Miles Davis, John Zorn, and Vijay Iyer are featured, as are classical composers, and tens of thousands of minor artists across genres. This 12 million track data set on its own would take 91 years to listen to. What the data sets illustrate primarily is the scale and variety of music easily available to AI developers. Companies often claim to use only content that is freely available online, but the data sets reveal the quantity of downloadable music that developers can access, even though it is not supposed to be free. Three of the data sets I found are distributed as a list of links to songs on YouTube or Spotify. AI developers download the actual audio using tools that automate the job, some of which allow developers to bypass logins, advertisements, and mechanisms that might earn money or subscribers for creators. The datasets are similar in size to those that companies have used to train commercial music-generating models. In 2022, Google trained a model on 44 million tracks, totaling 42 years of music. Suno wrote in a 2024 court filing that it trained its models on essentially all music files of reasonable quality that it could download from the internet. In general, AI companies defend their right to train models on unlicensed music by arguing that the training is, quote, fair use, end quote, under copyright law, meaning that AI models do not harm the market for creators' work. This is a complex claim, and the legality likely depends on specifics of how an AI system is trained and deployed. Suno declined to comment on its legal arguments. Metin Parlak, a spokesperson for OpenAI, told me that the company has always been transparent about how Jukebox was trained. Music-generating models work in a similar way to AI models that generate text. They break the training down into tiny pieces and learn about the context in which each piece appears. Then, when given a prompt or a context, they predict what piece comes next. The ease of generating AI music has quickly made it ubiquitous. Last September, Spotify said it had removed 75 million spammy AI-generated tracks from its service. The streaming platform Deezer recently reported nearly half of the tracks it receives daily are AI-generated. Unlike Spotify, Deezer excludes AI-generated tracks from its algorithmic recommendations and labels albums that include AI tracks, although it does not display labels for individual tracks. Among the companies offering AI music generation products, Google is uniquely positioned to take advantage of a large existing audience. The tech giant has begun embedding the technology into its products. Google's Gemini AI assistant can now generate 30-second music tracks based on a user's uploaded text, photos, or video. And the company encourages video makers on YouTube to use AI-generated backing tracks rather than licensing music from real musicians. For YouTubers who have gotten in trouble by using copyrighted music inappropriately, Google recently added a Replace Song button that will replace the music in their video with an AI-generated track. AI-generated music is being consumed directly on AI product websites as well. Suno and its competitor Udio can be used as listening platforms, much like Spotify or YouTube. The sites invite users to describe the music they want to hear and can generate a track in a matter of seconds. The songs are mostly mundane, but they can sound real enough that many listeners might struggle to recognize them as AI-generated. In an attempt to prevent their products from generating songs that duplicate existing music, AI companies implement detection software. But neither Suno nor Udio prevents users from generating songs in the style of real artists. Earlier this year, Sony found 135,000 AI-generated tracks attributed to its artists on various streaming platforms. Although it's not clear exactly which AI tools were used to generate those tracks, the technology is already harming artists' ability to make a living from their music. Musicians and labels have filed at least 12 lawsuits against AI companies for training models on copyrighted music. The lawsuits allege copyright infringement, but even some artists who have chosen to share their music more freely still object to how AI companies are using their work. A case in point is the Free Music Archive. It was started in 2009 by the New Jersey radio station WFMU to serve the same purpose as radio, providing free music to listeners, but designed for the age of the Internet, as the archive claimed on its original website. It's a gold mine for rare, live, and non-mainstream recordings, and it's a way for musicians to let listeners hear their music for free, typically while requiring that anyone who wants to make money from the music has to pay. Some artists also specify that their work cannot be used for commercial purposes. The guitarist and singer Derek Clegg has been sharing his original home-recorded songs for more than 15 years. Clegg told me he's happy for people to put his music in the background of their personal videos as long as they credit him. It seems dishonest, however. He feels it seems like theft. They are going to have a reckoning when they use his work without acknowledging. That's his hope, anyway. We are out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.